Canto 3, chapter 21, conversation between Manu and Kardama. Text 27. Atmajam asita pangim vayashila gunanvitam mrigayantim patim dasyati anurupayate prabho Atmajam, his own daughter, Asita, black, Apangim, eyes, Vayaha, grown-up age, Shila, with character, Guna, with good qualities, Anvitam, endowed, Mrigayantim, searching for. Patim, a husband. Dasyati, he will give. Anurupaya, who are suitable. Te, unto you. Prabho, my dear sir. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. He has a grown-up daughter whose eyes are black. She is ready for marriage and she has good character and all good qualities. She is also searching for a good husband. My dear sir, her parents will come and see you, who are exactly suitable for her, just to deliver their daughter as your wife. Please repeat. He has a grown-up daughter whose eyes are black. She is ready for marriage, and she has good character and all good qualities. She is also searching for a good husband. My dear sir, her parents will come to see you, who are exactly suitable for her, just to deliver their daughter as your wife. Purport. The selection of a good husband for a good girl was always entrusted to the parents. Here it is clearly stated that Manu and his wife were coming to see Kardama Muni to offer their daughter because the daughter was very well qualified and the parents were searching out a similarly qualified man. This is the duty of the parents. Girls are never thrown into the public street to search out their husband. For when girls are grown up and are searching after a boy, they forget to consider whether the boy they select is actually suitable for them. Out of the urge of sex desire, a girl may accept anyone. But if the husband is chosen by the parents, they can consider who is to be selected and who is not. According to the Vedic system, therefore, the girl is given over to a suitable boy by the parents. She is never allowed to select her own husband independently. He has a grown-up daughter whose eyes are black. She is ready for marriage and she has good character and all good qualities. She is also searching for a good husband. My dear sir, her parents will come to see you, who are exactly suitable for her, just to deliver their daughter as your wife. So apparently that's a notable feature if you've got black eyes. Yeah, not the ones from a punch in the face, but black eyes. If you look at a person, then there's an old Beatles song, "In Their Eyes There's Something Lacking." George Harrison wrote that one. What it means is that you can understand a person's state of consciousness by looking in their eyes. It's actually, out of all the senses, the eyes alone are directly connected to the brain. Yeah, they're kind of hot-wired straight into the brain. So a state of a person's consciousness can be understood by looking in their eyes. And if they're depthless, because if they're shallow, it means that there's not much going on there. Yeah, that's animals. Yeah, just like our Lakshmi Priya, the elephant. course, elephants are considered to be intelligent as far as animals go. But when you look in her eyes, there's not much happening there. She's an animal. Yeah, they got big eyes. But whatever they're seeing is very limited compared to what a human being observes, because a human being's consciousness is expanded. And that comes out through the eyes. So you can understand if a person's intelligent or not by looking in their eyes. You can understand the level of their consciousness just by observing their eyes there and what's going on there. So apparently here, if you have black eyes, that means that it's very difficult to see. The depth is there. Yeah, black eyes means if something's black, you can't see the features of it. That's good. That means intelligence. Yeah. So therefore, these black eyes, that's very considered to be a nice feature of a young lady. It means she's got good intelligence. Just a comment there. Now, as far as marriage goes, of course, that's something that practically everybody has to go through in this material world, as has already been explained by Kardama Muni. This world is created for the desires of the living beings. It's not created because God wants it. Yeah, Krishna has no requirement for a material world, a limited and temporary place. His place is eternal, it's unlimited, and it's all blissful. So why have a material world? That is for the living beings themselves. That means that they have desires, and those desires are separate from the desire to want to serve and constantly please the senses of the Supreme Lord. So when a living being has his own, or he has a sense of separateness from the Lord, he's given this material world, he can come, and he gets a certain set of senses, a certain kind of body, and a certain level of mind and intellect by which he can fulfill his desires for independent enjoyment. So in this material world, everybody has that spirit. Yeah, there's hardly anyone that has no desires. Everybody has some desire. Just like I was just reading in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, Narada Muni, he's going from one place to another, seeking out who has got the most mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And even he goes up to Lord Brahma, but still even Lord Brahma admits that I have some desire. That's why I'm in charge of the whole universe. He's executing some desire of his own. So he says, I'm not the one that's got the full mercy of the Lord. When Narada Muni comes up to the point where he visits the Dwarkavasis, and then ultimately, of course, the Vrindavanvasis, then he discovers there those living beings who have no other desire than pleasing the senses of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's their entire life. They don't know any other existence outside of the presence, or maybe not the presence, but, you know, the mood of serving the Supreme Lord. So that's the most exalted state. So in this material world, there's not so many people that are desireless. Desireless doesn't mean, you know, nothing is going on. Yeah, that you become a blank or a void. It means that one's desires are entirely centered on pleasing the senses of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's it. Nothing else. So anyway, in this material world, then even an elevated person like Kardama Muni, he has some desire. And the statement here is that if you have a desire, all right, that may be, you know, as we say, an independent desire from trying to please the senses of the Lord. You want to please your own senses. But even that should be fulfilled by the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Don't try to do it whimsically or independently, but depend upon the Supreme Personality, and he will make the arrangements by which your desires can be completely fulfilled. And at the same time, you'll eventually see the futility of them, and give them up and surrender to Him. That's the idea. So Kadama Muni, he's doing these penances and he wants to get a good wife. He has that desire, and that's natural. Everybody has that. The men want a good woman, the women want a good man. And in that way, then by their combination, some sense of enjoyment, at least for some time, that can be achieved. Yeah. Of course, in the course of fulfilling those desires, then there are so many limitations that become realized. The Prabhupada mentions that when you're in that first flush of attraction, yeah, that's what they call the romantic period, when a man meets a woman, then for 6 months or a year or up to about 2 years, then there's this romantic glitter, gloss, you know, which somehow or another, you know, the partner appears to be so effulgent that they have no fault. Yeah, they're perfect in every respect. Even if there is something that's not quite perfect, we don't worry about that. Yeah, we put that to one side because we're in that period of attraction. But then after some time, of course, when you settle down, the gloss wears off, the effulgence dies down, and then you have to deal with the person as they are and their character, their particular desires, you know, their idiosyncrasies, and of course you have your own. And, you know, whereas in the beginning period, each partner is willing to put aside their own demands. After that romantic period is over and you get down to the brass tacks of actually having to live together, then all, you know, these different characteristics and different desires start coming out, that you like to do things this way, but I like to do it this way. You know, you like to sleep on that side of the bed, but I like to sleep on that side of the bed, or whatever it is. You know, there's all the differences start coming out. So then you have to get down to the, you know, business of actually living together. And if there's not actually compatibility between the partners, then it finishes very quickly. Yeah, irreconcilable differences. That's one of the grounds for divorce nowadays. Irreconcilable differences that, you know, in the beginning we thought, oh, you know, this is going to be very nice. I love him, he loves me, like that. But then after just a very short period, then we find there's so many differences. And then it takes a lot of hard work. Yeah, what came naturally and easily in the beginning, just by a glance of the eyes, yeah, that's how it happens. They look in each other's eyes. Again, the same thing, the black eyes. By glancing in each other's eyes, there's a connection of consciousness. Yeah, the heart. The consciousness is actually, the heart is the center of all consciousness. And it comes, the consciousness is expressed through the eyes. That's why in Vedic culture, the girls were taught never to look into the eyes of a man. Yeah, because as soon as there's that connection between the eyes, there's some, you know, immediate attraction, there's some immediate connection between the heart of those two personalities. So out of shyness then, the girls were always trained, keep their eyes down, don't look in the eyes of a man. And similarly, the man also is very rude. It was considered very rude to look into the eyes of a woman. Yeah, this is culture. That way meant then there's some protection, yeah, between the men and the women, keeping some little distance between themselves and keeping some cordial dealings without immediately being agitated all the time by this principle of sex desire, calm. Yeah, that of course you have to deal with each other. Men and women are there. You can't separate them exactly. But by culture, there's a way of dealing with this problem, sex. Yeah, it is a problem. it's an agitation of the heart, It's a diversion of the living being's progress to go back home, back to Godhead, that you become attracted to something in this material world or someone in this material world with whom you want to enjoy. And that sense of enjoyment overpowers one's understanding of one's eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We become temporarily and immediately attracted to another ordinary living being. So in that way then, Vedic culture, they understood this problem of sex desire, and they had a system for dealing with it. Yeah, not that, you know, all right, because you have some desire, then you should immediately just go out there and try to fulfill it in any way possible. That's the mood of modern civilization. Yeah, as Prabhupada says here, the girls are thrown out onto the street to see if they can be picked up, you know, by some avaricious or lusty male. Yeah, they go off to the nightclubs, they go off to the discos, and they're out there only for one thing. Who's going to pick me up tonight? That's all. No thought about, you know, what the consequences of such a connection will be. Just, you know, the users and the used, that's all. Yeah, somebody posing themselves, you know, a man poses himself as being a big projector or a great enjoyer, and the woman poses herself in different ways to attract that man's attention. So in this way then, without knowing anything about each other, without knowing anything about their actual characteristics, simply out there, you know, every weekend, hooking, that's all it is. Trying to hook some man, a man's trying to hook some woman. And then what are the consequences? Yeah, social disturbance, that's all. After some time, then it becomes boring. Then I'll drop this one, pick up another one. Yeah. Then generally, as Prabhupada pointed out, it's the ghouls that are always left in the lurch. Yeah. If a man makes a woman pregnant, he doesn't have to live with the consequences. He can just go off, drop her, and go somewhere else. And then the girl is left literally holding the baby. Or not. You know, in modern society now, in order to avoid that problem, then they've made a system whereby now they convince the girls, it's all right, you can just get rid of it. Some tissue has appeared within your body, just abort it, that's all, somewhere in another, and go on with your enjoyment. Yeah, no sense at all that here is a living being. Yeah, of course, they like to argue, oh, this is just some tissue, or they give some technical name to dehumanize that embryo that's there within the womb. But if you just wait for a few months, you'll see whether it's a real human being or not. Yeah, one of the arguments about abortion is that it's not actually formed into a real human being yet. It's just a few cells that are combined together. Yeah. Well, okay, if it's not a human being, then leave it. What's the problem? But if you do leave it, then after a few months, you'll see whether it's a human being or not. Of course it is. It's just in the developmental stage, that's all. But by, you know, some word jugglery, and by this loss of understanding of what we are as living beings, what the purpose of human life is, being overtaken by these lusty desires that all we're here for is to just get out there and just get as much sense gratification as possible and damn the consequences. If the consequences come, we'll figure out some way or another, you know, to avoid them. That's all. So everybody's going out, we see, practically all over the world. That mixing, free mixing of men and women is going on, and with horrible consequences. Yeah. In America, of course, India now, they have the highest abortion rate in the world. Yeah. Every country in the world now, practically, 1-2 million abortions a year. You can't imagine how much killing is going on. All for what? So this free mixing can take place. Yeah, this is the consequence. They're just going out and trying to capture some man, trying to capture some woman, and then the natural end result. So this is a very, very unfortunate situation in human society. We should not think that we can escape the consequences of such activities. You may think that you're escaping the consequences of your uncontrolled sex life, yeah, mating like animals here, there, and everywhere, at any time, any place. And then when, you know, the baby comes, oh, you can just flush it out and go on as if nothing's happened. But the laws of nature, they're different. Yeah. There are consequences. You may artificially try to avoid them. But in trying to do that, then you increase the adverse consequences by, you know, taking these steps such as abortion, etc. And then you will have, in the future, to suffer the reactions for that. Prabhupada made that very clear, that if you abort a child, then in the future you get born in the womb of a mother who will abort you. You will never see the light of day. Yeah. I actually, interestingly enough, I had a relative, and she had an abortion. And then she died. She actually became a little mentally disturbed. Then she died. And later on, I met one, tantric guy. I asked him about that situation, and then he told me, yes, this person, I didn't tell him anything about this particular relative. I just asked, you know, gave the name and asked. And then he said, oh, this person, she took birth, she was put into the womb of a mother here and then aborted. And then put into another womb and then aborted. And then put in another womb and then aborted. And now she's a 5-year-old girl in Japan. So, like this. And at that time when he told me that, I had no real idea about the history of this particular relative. But later on, by some inquiry, I found out that she had actually had an abortion. And as a result of that abortion, she'd become mentally disturbed. And so this man, because whether you believe it or not, but anyway, he had some insight. And he was saying how he understood immediately that this woman, you know, had an abortion, and now she'd been aborted 2 or 3 times, you know, in consequent births before she was allowed to take birth again herself. So these things are going on. People may not believe in the laws of nature, but the laws of nature are not subject to our belief. They're there. Whatever we do, there is a consequence for it. Whatever action that we perform, there is a very definite result, and it will come. So one cannot avoid that. So in order to avoid the disaster, in order to avoid disturbances, social disturbances, then this business, especially of the male and female combining together, this was handled very, very carefully. Yeah, because, of course, 99% or 99.9% of the world's population, they will become married. The desires are there. And that is nature's way, that male and female, they'll be attracted automatically. You cannot avoid that. Just like the sage Rishyasringa, he was brought up in the jungle, actually. Never saw a woman in his whole life till he was in his mid-20s. His father kept him separate. And he actually had no idea there was such a thing as a woman. Apparently he had no mother at that point. But he was brought up by his father in the forest. Then one day when his father was away, there was some arrangement made from a kingdom just bordering where he was living. They had been informed, this Rishyasringa has to come here because we're having a drought. If you bring this sage Rishyasringa, then that will be ended. So how to capture him? So then one lady was employed. You go there and you capture this sage. So he was living in the jungle. He'd never seen a woman before. She came upon him when his father was away. And immediately, boom, he was attracted. Oh, who are you? I haven't seen anybody like you before. What are those two raised mounds on your chest? Immediately he was attracted. Never seen a woman before, but automatically it comes. So it can't be avoided. Sex desire is there, and we have to deal with it. So it should be dealt with in such a way that there's some actual something productive, something good, something spiritually progressive should come from that. So Kardama Muni, he had his desire. And the Supreme Lord, he knew about that desire. He's within the heart of every living being. He knew perfectly well what Kardama Muni wanted. And he, being in the heart of every living being, also knew the desires of another particular living entity who would be a good match. Yeah, who by their combination something productive would come. So that was the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, Devahuti, although she was living somewhere else. But by the Lord's arrangement, then he informed Kardama Muni that you're a very qualified man and I have made an arrangement to find you a very qualified woman. So the point that Prabhupada's making there is that by a higher arrangement, if things are done, then everything can come out very nicely. But if it is just the arrangement, you know, the pushes and pulls of the senses, like the animals, no higher, you can say the lower consciousness, the lower arrangements, you won't get any good result. But if you have a higher arrangement, consciously everything is done very nicely, then you can expect some, nice situation to be developed from that. So in the Vedic culture, every girl and every boy, they were married by the arrangement of the parents, because the parents actually have experience. Yeah, they know something about the combination of male and female. They know something about social life and how to live it nicely. And they've had plenty of time to observe the characteristics of their children. The children themselves may not be mature enough to know what their own particular propensities are, due to immaturity. And when a desire comes out, it's very difficult to control it. We all know that, especially in teenage years. You're just on that stage of, becoming a little independent, becoming your own person, but not having the maturity to be able to deal with that independence properly. So everybody knows that, there's a certain period in teenage life where many of the kids go wild, because they're broken free from, the guidance of the parents, but at the same time they have no experience in how to deal with the world. So all parents, they generally tend to be very, anxious about their kids when they get into that late teen period. What will happen to them? Will they even make it? I mean, at least I remember my own, period of youth, late teens. We were wild. As soon as we got out of the house, that was it. We did all kinds of crazy stuff, and I'm sure many others have had that experience. And when I look back, I think I could have been killed at any moment, many times. On my motorcycle, the crazy things that we used to do, and, going out in the nightclubs and pubs and getting in fights and all kinds of things. No control and no experience. So rather than have that situation, then Vedic culture was that everything should be very carefully guided. Even when a person comes to a point where he becomes independent from the parents. But in one sense, they're not independent, because the Vedic culture was that when a child comes to the age of 16, then at that point, you don't tell them what to do anymore. You advise them. Smaller children, you order them. But when they come to the age of 16, then they have to simply be made a friend and advised. And if the relationship between the parents and the children is nice, if it's respectful, then the children continue to take their advice of their parents, even though they begin to live their own lives. So, this is culture. The word culture, it means to grow, cultivate. We say the farmers in the fields, they're cultivators. They're growing things. So in the same way, a culture means that system, social system, which enables a person to grow in their consciousness, to develop their consciousness. So what is that growth? That growth is to get a better sense of the self, to get a sense of what we are, how we're situated in this universe, what is our future. Yeah, this is cultivation. Thinking about the future, thinking about how to improve things. Not acting like animals, day-to-day existence, just bouncing from one thing to another. Yeah, whatever sensual stimulus that comes along, I immediately react. That's animal life. That's not culture. So nowadays, people don't have much culture. They don't have any foresight or view of the future. They don't know who they are. They don't know why they're here, and they don't know where they're going. And therefore, they're willing to do anything and everything without any thought of the consequences. Yeah? Without any thought of the consequences. If one has a proper sense of the self, then he knows there will be consequences. There is a future. Even when I have to leave this body, there'll be another body, and another body, and another body. Now, where am I going? Yeah? What is my destination? What is actual improvement? This is culture. So Vedic society was based on a spiritual culture, giving people right from birth the understanding of what they actually are as living beings, spirit souls, not this body. And then guiding them with a view so there will be gradual improvement throughout their lives. So even if there are desires, material desires, it doesn't matter. If you have a culture, you can deal with that in such a way. Those desires may become fulfilled. But at the same time, something higher, you know, some higher experience of happiness can also be attained by spiritual practices. So here, at least anyway, Kadama Muni, he's making that progress. Devahuti, she's making that progress. They're just at the age where they need to be married. And now their parents are taking an interest in how to get them into a situation which will actually be progressive for them, where that culture can continue. Not that, you know, now they'd just be let out loose and, you know, potentially face some disaster, you know, from not being able to control themselves and from not understanding maturely how to deal with their own lives. So this is not, you know, a system of enslavement. The parents, you know, taking the girl and, oh, you have to marry this man. Oh, I've never met him before. No, it doesn't matter. You have to marry him. It's not like that. They studied very carefully by astrology also. You can understand the characteristics of a particular living being, what their propensities are. And by comparing the horoscopes of the boy and girl, you can understand whether they will actually be able to live together or not. Yeah, Prabhupada said, this is civilized life. It's a science. It's not some mumbo jumbo, but it's actually, you know, every living being, when they take birth in a particular body, in a particular place, they come under the influence or higher influences of various planets. And their life can be mapped out according to the movements of those planets and the prevailing influences on that particular person. So whatever characteristics that they have can immediately be understood by an expert astrologer. So in that way then, by looking at the compatibility of the charts, it can be understood whether this boy and girl will actually be able to live together or not for the long term. Once you get over that, you know, honeymoon period, the 6 months or 1 year, when the infatuation dies down, can this boy and girl actually live together, yeah, in a sane and sober fashion, and then bring up their own children without disruption and also make their spiritual progress? So some thought was there. This is a responsibility of a parent. To try to situate their children in the most favourable place possible. So especially with the girls, because Prabhupada says here that they're very vulnerable. Girls tend to be very emotional, more emotional than men. Yeah? This is not stereotyping, this is a fact. Yeah? There are different natures, boys and girls. I remember actually one time in London, I was living there in 1985. I met this couple, and they had a small son. And they'd never met the devotees before. He was a computer guy, and I'd gone there to get my computer fixed. Anyway, I started talking. You know, they understood I was a devotee. So we were having our Rathiatra, so I invited them for the Rathiatra. He didn't come, but the wife came, and she brought her son. So her son and my daughter, they were kind of playing together. And the son was very aggressive, you know, doing what little boys do, you know, running here and there and rough and tumble. And, you know, there's a very striking difference between the boy and the girl. And this woman was looking and she said, wow, she said, they're so different, boys and girls. She said, I never understood that before. She said, I'm a socialist. She said, I've been brought up a socialist. I've been brought up to believe that boys and girls are the same. But she said, I can see that my boy and your girl are completely different just by their natures. So I said, yes. I said, but that's the unfortunate educational system that we have, that people are brainwashed into thinking that everybody is the same. They're not. There's a very distinct characteristics of boys and girls. They are different. Yeah. And that continues. It's not that when we become adults that those, you know, changes or those differences disappear. They don't. They actually become more pronounced. Yeah. So, and nowadays there's a branch of medicine, gender-specific medicine, where they've actually started to finally admit that men's bodies and women's bodies work differently. Yeah. Their minds actually work differently, the way that they perceive things and view things. There's some differences. So the same medicine does not work in the same way that you give to a man, you give the same medicine to a woman. It's different. There are differences because the bodies are different. The hormonal structures are different. The biological structures are different. And therefore also the mentality is also a little different in the way that we deal with things. So anyway, this is not a very popular thing to say that men and women are different. You know, but it's a fact. This is nature's arrangement. Yeah, Krishna has made the bodies of human beings in different ways. Just like we have Varnashram. Yeah, there's the Shudras, the Vaishyas, the Kshatriyas, and the Brahmanas. They also have some differences in state of consciousness and even in the way, you know, that physically they do things. So if we artificially say, no, there's no differences, and force everybody, you know, into the same slot, it doesn't work. It causes endless problems in human society. But if you recognize there are differences, and then you respond according to those differences, and you deal with the person according to their actual natures, then in that way, then they can be happy, you'll be happy, and the rest of society will become happy also. So particularly then, Prabhupada points out that girls, young girls, they're very susceptible. Some handsome man comes along, you know, flashes and, you know, and immediately the girl becomes attracted like that. And that principle of attraction blinds her. She can't see what the man actually is. And in that way, then she can be very easily manipulated and used. And that's what's going on in, you know, regular society. That we see especially that the girls are being misused by unscrupulous men. Yeah. And the end result is social havoc. And nobody has any chance for any real spiritual progress, which is the real point. Yeah. Of course, an organized society, but without any spiritual progress, is useless also. the spiritual progress should be there. But it's very difficult to progress spiritually, to have a sense of what I am and where am I going, and have that, you know, introversion, yeah, that ability to look within and to step back from things and, you know, really consider what am I as a living being. It's very difficult to have that if externally everything is in havoc, if everything is upside down, if you're fighting with this one and fighting with that one, or, you know, all of a sudden you come home one day and, you know, the husband kicks you out the house, or, you know, now we're divorcing. You know, social chaos. Then what chance has anybody got for spiritual progress? So social organization is very important, but for a purpose. Yeah, not just for increasing one's sense gratification, but for a spiritual, a higher purpose. Then there's social organization. So Vedic life was very organized, but done very, very intelligently and scientifically, with sensitivity to the actual natures of boys and girls. Yeah, child is the future of man. In other words, those who are children today become the leaders of human society tomorrow. So the progress of human society depends upon how we deal with our children. Yeah, whether or what sense we give them of what they are and what their position is in the world and how they deal with each other. So this was, you know, very big concern that parents, they have to take a responsibility, they have to take an interest in what happens to their children for the future of human society. So here we see a good example that Swayambhuva Manu, he's coming with his daughter to present to a suitable man, Kadama Muni. And he also has been advised by God himself, because we may not all be in that position, but he's been advised by God himself that there will, in 2 days' time, this girl will come to you. You accept her because she's just suitable match for you. You will be very compatible together. And as a result of that, you'll be actually so compatible that I've decided that I'll take birth in her womb through your semen. So you're going to be my dad. Right? Kapila Muni, I'm going to appear within, you know, from the combination of you and Devahuti. So I've made this arrangement. And Kadama Muni is, you know, naturally very happy to accept that. So this, you know, whole propaganda that unless a boy and a girl get to see each other, oh, it's some kind of cruelty, yeah, to get them married. No, it's not. Yeah. You have a better chance of having a successful marriage if your parents take an interest, you know, and give some proper guidance and find you a nice boy or a nice girl to get married to, then, as Prabhupada says, being booted out onto the street to, you know, wander around here and there, hoping beyond hope, you know, where is some suitable partner? Yeah? It's very hit and miss. So Vedic culture is not hit and miss. It's very carefully planned. And by that planning, then you get peace and, you know, happiness in human society. And if you don't have control, then finished. That's it. All right, so we'll finish there. Does anybody have any questions? Vishuddha Sattva Prabhu. Well, what we read in the Bhagavatam, of course, is the ideal system where that entire society was supporting that system. When you're in a situation where general society doesn't support it, and, you know, you're in a kind of like a microcosm, but the macrocosm is different, then... Yes. And we badly miss that in ISKCON. Yeah, we're kind of, we've got one foot in one culture and the other foot in the other culture. And we haven't yet developed a Vedic spiritually based culture
to support our activities, especially in the West, where our temples are there. And, you know, that in itself has been a disturbance, because there's been some artificial attempts to introduce, you know, Vedic culture, or what we think is Vedic culture. That's the other thing, is that, you know, at least in the early days of ISKCON, when we were in the full flush of, you know, enthusiasm for our newly found spiritual lives, you know, rejecting our old cultures and then trying to take up Vedic culture. But our understanding of what Vedic culture actually is was very, very limited. And so our attempts to introduce it also didn't always prove to be very useful. And unfortunately, we had a whole generation of kids that suffered as a result of that. So there's no denying that. I think it's just a question that things like these, they have to gradually grow. Yeah. When we have an actual realization about the value of the culture, then you can actually figure out how to implement it. If it's just something intellectual, some idea, you know, when you try to implement that, then very often it doesn't get done properly, and the end result is more havoc. Yeah. I think that for a lot of our kids, at least that earlier generation, first generation of kids, the only real benefit that they got was that at least they knew about Krishna and they got the basic philosophy. But our, you know, our cultural attempts have not been very successful. So we have a lot to learn yet. We've really got to develop that. And that was why Prabhupada stressed trying to create communities, you know, especially on the land, where you can build a culture, actually. As long as you're economically tied in with, you know, the greater society, you're dependent on that, and you come under its influence, and the values also. And actually, the value of Vedic culture does not become very apparent, because it's not practical. When you live, to live, the first consideration is economic. You've got to earn a living. Now, in our communities, from what I've seen, nobody's earning their living within the community. They're living on farms or whatever, but they're going outside to earn the money. That means they're dependent on the outside culture, and therefore the relevance of Krishna conscious culture, beyond just chanting and, you know, some of the daily practices, it's just not apparent. Yeah. So Prabhupada knew that, and therefore he advised us to build communities that were self-sufficient. Self-sufficient means by culture. Economically self-sufficient. And once you're economically self-sufficient, you can build your culture on that basis. Yes. Well, that's culture, yes. Social. It's a social network. Everybody becomes interdependent. Yeah. Well, India, of course, is... Prabhupada said it's like a dead elephant. Yeah. A dead elephant is still valuable, tusks and whatever you get from that. So Vedic culture in India is dead, and it has been dead for a long time. But still, a dead elephant is valuable. Yeah. So he said it is possible that you could come to a point of reviving Vedic culture, but that is a very big task, especially you can see in India. You know, everybody's moving in just the opposite direction. And now, you know, they're being more than ever swept up by Western cultural values and losing their spiritual values. Now, I used to think that ISKCON was meant for saving the West, right? The rest, everything outside of India. It was Prabhupada came to the West to save all the people of the world that didn't know anything about Krishna consciousness at all. But nowadays, I think that Prabhupada's appearance was to save India. Yeah. Because if India doesn't retain its spiritual values, there's no hope for anywhere else in the world. Yeah. India is the place where that culture was retained originally. And it can be revived here. There's still enough connection with it that people can still appreciate it. But if it's lost in India, it will be lost everywhere in the world. There'll be no examples left to follow. So Prabhupada's appearance actually was to save India, and then that would automatically mean there's some hope for the rest of the world. Mayapur. Mayapur is the future. But anyway, we have a lot of work to do. We have to understand what these cultural values are. And somehow or another, we've got to implement them, but in a sensible way, not fanatically or, you know, immaturely. They've got to be done nicely. It will take some time. In the meantime, chant Hare Krishna.